From Harrisburg to Pittsburgh, Gettysburg to Greensburg, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, the Pennsylvania Department of State has chosen a new technology platform to administer elections. Heather Honey of the Election Research Institute is here to discuss the changes and the impact. How do you determine whether or not an organization is truly nonprofit and therefore exempt from paying property taxes? Eric Montardi and Alex Sodini discuss on this week's Allegheny Institute report. And it is time. Pennsylvanians are given more control over their health care options. Emily Green from Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, has a Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Heather Honey from the Election Research Institute in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Pennsylvania Attorney General Dave Sunday has joined 25 other state attorneys general in filing an amicus brief urging the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit to, quote, lift a nationwide restraining order that is preventing the immediate deportation of Trend to Argue gang members. The Center Square reports the AGs contend that President Trump's order to deport the gang members is, quote, grounded in clear constitutional and statutory authority. In January, Trump designated Tren de Aragua a foreign terrorist organization, along with seven other cartels from Latin America. The trend of blue states losing population and red states gaining population continues. The migration started during COVID, but has continued largely due to the high taxes and policy failures in blue states. The end result will be an electoral vote boost for Republicans following the 2030 census. Pennsylvania is among the states lagging behind in population growth. As a result, we will likely lose one congressional district when redistricting takes place in 2032. It will be Election Day this Tuesday for some voters in Lancaster and Allegheny counties. A special election will be held to fill the seat of former Senator Ryan Aumont, who resigned to become U.S. Senator David McCormick's state director. The seat tilts strongly Republican, with County Commissioner Josh Parsons favored to win. The Allegheny State House seat became open with the untimely death of Representative Matt Gergely in January. That has deadlocked the House at 101 Democrats and 101 Republicans. That district tilts strongly Democrat, advantaging Democrat Dan Kochnar. Should he prevail, that would restore the Democrats' one-seat majority in the lower chamber. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Pennsylvania and its election process is always in the national spotlight, and the state's current technology is outdated and about to be replaced. But there are risks. To learn more, we turn to Heather Honey. She is Executive Director of the Election Research Institute. Heather, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Heather, we're going to talk about where Pennsylvania's Department of State is going, and you can even explain why the Department of State is involved what they do. But tell us a bit about the election platform, the election process that Pennsylvania has used up until this point.
Right now, Pennsylvania is operating a proprietary system. It's the Statewide Uniform Registry of Electors, or people refer to it as the SURE system. And the SURE system was developed in-house, internally, after the Help America Vote Act was passed, which mandated that every state had to have a single uniform statewide computer system for voter registration. Prior to that, different counties had different systems. Some counties were doing it on paper. And so the mandate was to sort of update and modernize. And so HAVA, of course, HAVA was after the Hanging Chads situation. So the idea was to modernize the system. And the mandate was to have every state create a single uniform integrated computer system. And so that was what prompted Pennsylvania to start the development of this SURE system. Now, the beginnings of this started sometime in late 2002, again, after HAVA passed. it was developed on, like I said, in-house. So unlike what we're doing right now, where they're going out and they're trying to buy like off-the-shelf programs from vendors, instead, what Pennsylvania did is that they built it in-house, right? So they leveraged sort of existing infrastructure. I think they had to like purchase servers and stuff like that. And then every county had a designated workstation that was all connected to that. So the system was like operational, I think, by 2003, 2004. There was like a staggered rollout. So some counties came online before others. But ultimately, by 2004, all of the counties were connected and using these designated workstations. So let's use that as like the starting date, right? So 2004, the estimates of what it cost for Pennsylvania to build this system in-house was somewhere in the neighborhood of like $3 million initially, in 2003 dollars. And the system has served Pennsylvania well since then. And so I guess overall, like my initial question would be kind of like, why didn't we just redesign something internally? Probably would have cost less money, been more secure, that kind of thing. But that's where we are right now. Obviously, a 20-year-old computer system has some, there have been many upgrades to it over the years, but it is a 20-year-old system as it was built. And so based on that, the department decided in 2019, actually, that they needed to replace the entire system.
So we have this older system. It was in effect, as you pointed out, Heather, for 2024. Your organization, the Election Research Institute, has monitored elections here. Pennsylvania, of course, a battleground state, so pretty much everybody was monitoring our election last year. In your view, how did Pennsylvania perform in terms of efficiency and accuracy in 2024? It seemed at the outset like it went better than it did in 2020, but did it do well?
I think that there were some significant changes between 2020, when I think that most people, objective people, would agree that it was somewhat of a debacle. But there were a lot of changes, a lot of improvements between 2020 and 2024 from an overall election administration standpoint. And one of the most significant changes was actually Act 88, which required counties to do a few things. So if you remember, Act 88 was Pennsylvania's like Zuckerbuck's van, where they said no private funding in elections. But in exchange for that, in our divided government, there was a negotiated agreement where the counties would get grants from the state in exchange for some election administration compliance. So number one, they had to report, well, they had to first start counting absentee ballots and not stop. Right. So they had to begin the counting and there could be no interruption. So you're not going to have a 2 o'clock in the morning. We're going to stop counting. We'll come back tomorrow morning. Once they started counting at 7 a.m. on election day, the mail and the absentee ballots, that had to continue without interruption until they were done. I think that that was a huge improvement, because all of this like stopping and starting, there were lots of reports about issues around that. But more importantly, every county, if they wanted the grant funding, they were required to, by midnight on election day, report the total number of absentee ballots that they had received. So they didn't have to have them counted by then, but they had to say, hey, this is how many we received by the 8 p.m. deadline. So that put a cap on kind of like how many ballots could enter into the system. And I think that was a really significant improvement here in terms of election administration. Now, as it relates to the SURE system, though, let's keep in mind that voting systems are not related to the SURE system. And that's intentional, right? Because the SURE system is our statewide voter registration system. And because we vote anonymously, when you go to vote, you check in either on a paper poll book, right? Make sure your name is in the poll book, or on an electronic poll book. And that's the end of where you are an individual, because then you're going to get your ballot and you are going to vote it and you're going to put it into the voting machines anonymously. So they cannot tie back any ballot in a voting machine back to a voter. So, you know, when you talk about how did the SURE system work in 2024, it's sort of apples and oranges, right? But the SURE system, for its purposes in the election, right, the SURE system is where we generate those paper poll books, right? So if you go to vote in a polling place that has those big binders with all those papers, those poll books, or district registers, as they're called in the election code, are printed from the voter registration system or the SURE system. Counties that have implemented this electronic poll book, you know, where you're checking in on like basically what looks like an iPad, those are loaded from the SURE system. So in terms of how did that work for us in the election, I didn't hear too many problems with paper poll books, right? Because that's the good old-fashioned way. There were some reported issues with glitches on the electronic poll books. But in terms of Election Day operations, that's really the extent of what the SURE system does for Election Day voting. Of course, the SURE system, every person who requests a mail ballot has to be in the SURE system as well.
Let's take a look now at what the Department of State is planning to go to, the CIVEX system. Tell us a bit about that company and what you know about it, and are there any concerns with the pending switchover?
The whole reason that Pennsylvania had to issue an RFP in 2024 was because of the 2019 RFP, which led to a $10 million contract in 2020 with a company called BPRO. BPRO failed to meet their marks. The BPRO contract was a $10 million contract signed in December of 2020, which was supposed to be a complete replacement of the SURE system by 2023. There were tons of delays, and ultimately, in December of 2023, Pennsylvania terminated the contract with BPRO. And of that $10 million, I think we were in the hole $1.8 million. We got some money back, but the taxpayers lost $1.8 million on a failed contract with the previous vendor. So now fast forward to 2025, when last month the Department of State announced that they had selected a new vendor, and they had awarded the contract, as you mentioned, to a company called CIVEX. Now, CIVEX is really just a brand name that's given to a group of what they call operating units. The entity involved here is majority owned by a private equity firm out of Indiana called Hammond, Kennedy, and Whitney. And the election technology, and in fact, the contract that they signed was signed by PCC Technologies, which is a subsidiary of GCR Holdings. You can see it's this whole conglomerate of companies, and CIVEX is just the sort of brand name that they give to it. But again, the contract was signed by this company, PCC Technologies. Now, again, because this is a whole bunch of acquisitions and partnerships and agreements and that sort of thing, I would say that my concerns are sort of related to, my concerns are related to several things. The first thing is the business background here. So in the RFP, one of the questions that the Department of State asked was kind of, how long have you been in business and what are you doing? Well, their response was that CIVEX has been providing services for 28 years. Well, CIVEX was only formed in 2020. I mean, that's the fact of the matter. They were formed in 2020. There were additional acquisitions in 2021. They acquired they entered into an agreement with a company called Demtech to get some additional services under their belt. So really, this brand name CIVEX is pieced together by a bunch of different entities and a bunch of different technologies, and they've really only been around as CIVEX for 3 or 4 years. So they're claiming in the RFP that they've been doing this for 28 years is a little bit of a stretch, in my opinion, because this conglomeration, the one that Pennsylvania has now agreed to, has been sort of like a patchwork quilt put together over the course of the last, say, 4 years or so.
We have been talking with Heather Honey, who is Executive Director of the Election Research Institute. Heather, tell us a little bit about the Election Research Institute. This is a very involved process and topic. Tell us where folks can go also to learn more.
We are a nonpartisan, nonprofit entity dedicated really to transparency in elections. Our website, if anybody wants to learn a little bit more about what we're doing, is the electionresearchinstitute.org, electionresearchinstitute.org.
Heather Honey of the Election Research Institute. Heather, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Municipal governments, especially the state's largest cities, continue to struggle with how to determine what properties are exempt from real estate taxes because they are owned by a purely public charity. For a closer look at the issue, we turn to Eric Montardi and Alex Sodini and this Allegheny Institute report.
Hello and welcome to the Allegheny Institute report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is Alex Sodini, research associate at the Allegheny Institute. Alex, you recently wrote a policy brief available at our website, www.alleghenyinstitute.org. It deals with the city of Pittsburgh and how it is going after the tax-exempt status of certain types of exempt property. Specifically, these are what is referred to as purely public charities. Alex, can you describe what the city of Pittsburgh's charitable property challenge is and why it is being done?
The city's charitable challenge stems from the fact that Pittsburgh has long been home to a number of large nonprofits that are exempt from paying property taxes, colloquially dubbed the Big Five, which includes UPMC, Allegheny Health Network, and then the three universities, Pitt, Duquesne, and Carnegie Mellon. So the Pennsylvania Constitution allows for property tax exemptions for purely public charities, but it doesn't explicitly define what those are. Case law from a 1985 PA Supreme Court case lays out the requirements to be considered a purely public charity. And so to be designated as a purely public charity and granted tax-exempt status, you have to meet the following requirements: advancing a charitable purpose, relieving government of some of its burden, operating free from a private profit motive, benefiting a substantial number of people who are legitimate subjects of charity, and then donating or rendering gratuitously a number of services. The city's challenge, it really is on two different fronts. First, the city wants to make sure that nonprofits are paying their quote fair share. The argument there is simply that many of these institutions benefit from public services, whether that's mass transit, public works, roads and infrastructure, and public safety, but they are exempt from paying property taxes and therefore aren't necessarily contributing to those services despite benefiting from them. And then at the same time, the city is also alleging that some of the properties owned by purely public charities don't necessarily meet the requirements of that test, which is known as the HUP test. And they wanted to challenge them to get them back on the tax rolls. So beginning in 2023, the mayor passed an executive order which stated that the finance and law departments were going to begin reviewing a number of parcels that were connected to these purely public charities, again with the intent to ensure fairness by having tax-exempt properties that do not meet the HUP requirements to pay their fair share in taxes. The county's Office of Property Assessments heard the challenges and made the final decision as to whether the parcels would remain tax-exempt or be returned to taxables.
What were the results of the 2024 challenges?
In addition to the 27 challenges that were made in 2023, 104 parcels were challenged in 2024. The parcel's total assessed value was $785.2 million, though 76% of that was just two hospitals, UPMC Children's and Allegheny General. If all of the challenges were successful and applying the millage rates of the three taxing bodies, so Allegheny County, the City of Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh Public Schools, these properties would generate about $20 million in property tax revenue annually, with $6.9 million of that going to the city. The two large hospitals would generate $5.3 million by themselves to the city. However, the results were disappointing compared to the potential $20 million, with only 21 successful challenges out of the total of 104. Four of those successful challenges were land only, and the total assessed value of the group was only $13.9 million, with the highest value parcel around $5.3 million that recently sold in 2024 that has the use code of nursing home or private hospital. For all three taxing bodies, these 21 parcels would generate about $354,000 annually, while the city would take home $122,000 of that. So this leaves 83 properties that remain tax exempt, 29 of which were land only. The total assessed value of those properties was $771.3 million. They would have generated about $19.7 million in property tax revenue, and then $6.8 million of that would go to the city. Overall, those two large hospitals accounted for much of the assessed value and potential revenue generated. Overall, the city ended up winning less than a quarter of its total challenges, and many of those parcels remain tax exempt and therefore will be missing out on a bulk of the revenue, which is pretty disappointing for the city.
How much money is the city spending to undertake these challenges?
City Council approved a contract for up to $150,000 for an outside firm to help with legal services related to real estate matters. That was later amended up to $400,000. News reports put the total amount estimated around $247,000 that has been spent so far. However, the city solicitor noted that much of the work would be handled in-house before drawing upon the contracted services. Unfortunately, there is no record kept as to how much of this work has been done in-house versus contracted out, and there is no way of knowing the man hours that was spent by the city's law department. So as of now, there really is no concrete measure as to the taxpayer dollars that were spent. Regardless of how much they spent, it is highly likely that the cost will far exceed the amount that was generated by these successful challenges. Additionally, there is no telling how many appeals will be made based on the challenges that the city lost and wants to appeal, or successful challenges that owners want to appeal, further adding to potential future legal expenses in addition to the amounts already expended.
What could the city do in order to grow its tax base in a way that does not rely on challenging charitable property?
As evidenced by the lack of results from both the manpower and the legal expenses already undertaken, it's clear that challenging tax-exempt property is not a long-term solution to shore up the city's finances. Pittsburgh has continued to face financial headwinds, and the 2025 budget forecast expects the wage tax to overtake property tax revenue for the foreseeable future. For Pittsburgh to grow its tax base, a good first step would be returning unproductive property that it owns back onto the tax rolls. Between the Urban Redevelopment Authority, the Pittsburgh Land Bank, and then the three taxing bodies, there are a number of interests in stemming blight, abandoned, and vacant property. In doing so, the city would be able to generate additional revenues while also stemming maintenance and legacy costs related to holding unproductive property. Additionally, Pittsburgh Public Schools is considering consolidating some of its schools, and the closures need to make their way back onto the tax rolls, and the city should urge the school district to do so, rather than being held by the school district, which some from previous closings still are. Unfortunately, there are a number of regulatory hurdles that can make redeveloping property difficult. Between building requirements and permits, zoning laws, high construction costs, high interest rates for borrowing, community input and/or delays, potential inclusionary zoning, and then affordable housing mandates, which makes it difficult to return properties. So a comprehensive review needs to be done to help ease the regulatory and financial burden on developments and returning property back to the tax rolls, rather than relying on subsidies and diversions, which only further diminish property tax revenues and benefit some private developers at the expense of others. Lastly, it should be noted, while growing the property tax base is important, the city should not be focused on expanding the public sector, but rather focusing on core and necessary services.
Well said, Alex. For Alex Sedini, this is Eric Montardi, and this has been the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal.
Less regulation and more consumer choice would give Pennsylvanians better personal health care. So says Emily Green of Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
What's AFP's favorite trend of 2025? That's an easy answer. It's the renewed enthusiasm for getting government out of the way from preventing you from living your American dream. Recent polls have shown that almost 3/4 of Americans support the mission of DOGE, or the Department of Government Efficiency. We agree that transparency and accountability are important, and that's why AFP has made it our mission for over 2 decades to tackle burdensome regulations that impact taxpayers' day-to-day lives. While many think of regulatory barriers as hindering our economic prosperity through preventing the approval of permits in a timely manner, or keeping businesses from investing in the Commonwealth, there's other ways in which regulatory barriers keep us from success. Governmental overreach in our healthcare system, through the means of new licensure, keep many Pennsylvanians from accessing high-quality, low-cost care. That's why Americans for Prosperity launched the Personal Option, a campaign to highlight the need for greater independent choice and control in your care. You know what's best for your family, and that's why healthcare should be customized to fit your individual needs. By rejecting a top-down approach to healthcare, we can ensure better healthcare outcomes for Pennsylvania's patients. This legislative session in Harrisburg brings opportunity for bipartisan solutions that address the regulatory barriers within our healthcare system. First, with the introduction of Senate Bill 25, Full Practice Authority for Nurse Practitioners, Harrisburg can address our healthcare provider shortage by modernizing our current licensure laws around certified registered nurse practitioners to remove the burdensome collaborative agreements with physicians, which ultimately prevents nurse practitioners from practicing in areas of the Commonwealth where we need them most. Additionally, this enjoys widespread support. Polling shows that over half of Pennsylvanians support this measure. Now's not the time for archaic restrictions to hold qualified practitioners back from addressing our patients' most critical needs. In a similar vein, a new regulation from the Department of State Bureau of Professional and Occupational Affairs, currently sitting in the proposed phase with the Independent Regulatory Review Commission, would add additional burdensome requirements to those seeking to become a licensed practical nurse or a certified nurse aide. This is concerning for a multitude of reasons, but one concern remains at the forefront. This new proposed regulation, which would hinder our access to care, has the ability to circumvent the legislature, which is your voice in Harrisburg. Pennsylvanians can't afford to have unnecessary regulatory barriers to care burden our aging population. Harrisburg, through the legislative process, should be working to address and remove restrictions to care, as opposed to allowing bureaucrats to draft new barriers, which only feed into our growing healthcare shortage. Our words of wisdom to policymakers in Harrisburg: embrace regulatory reform, embrace a personal option, and, of course, embrace legislative oversight over decisions that impact the lives of our roughly 13 million Pennsylvanians across the Commonwealth. Head to personaloption.com to learn more. This is Emily Green, State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. The annual Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is now less than 2 weeks away. The Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is the premier gathering of conservative activists each year in the Keystone State. This year's Pennsylvania Leadership Conference will be held April 3rd through 5th at the Penn Harris Convention Center in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. Featured dinner speaker will be Kayleigh McEnany, who served as Donald Trump's first White House press secretary and currently is co-host of Outnumbered on the Fox News Channel. Additional speakers will include John Gizzi of Newsmax, U.S. Senator David McCormick, along with Steve Moore and Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council. The conference will include additional speeches, panel presentations, workshops, and social events. Complete information and registration for the Conservative Event of the Year, the 2025 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference, can be found at paleadershipconference.org. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.